the contents of the following program from the North Carolina Reading Service are intended for our blind and print-impaired audience. Welcome to this week's reading of Indie Week, and this issue dated December 22nd of 2022. I'm John Federson, and I'm reading to you from our nearly deserted radio studio this week by only a skeleton staff and, of course, our musicians, in this case, the massed bands of the Schleswig-Holstein Royal Artillery Brigades. Danke schön. Danke, danke. And as they march out, we hope to have them marching back into our studio at the close of broadcast today. And, of course, holiday season is upon us. In addition to Hanukkah, Christmas is just a few days away in the midst of a big winter storm coming our way. But this article from IndieWeek.com, the online version, has a Christmas-related article called Painting the Night Sky with 120,000 Lights. It's from Durham, and Claire Kramer published this on December 21st. Traveling north up Guess Road, the darkness of the trees and fleeting houses is broken up suddenly by flashing lights. On the right side of the road sits a winter wonderland with a sign telling people, tune in to 90.3 FM. The dark, the trees, and fleeting houses is broken up, these flashing lights. Searching through your radio, you'll find that all those flashing lights you see in front of you are synchronized to each beat and lyric of Christmas music. There are 120,000 lights, blue, yellow, purple, green, pink, and red. They light up Mr. and Mrs. Claus, trees, ho-ho-ho signs, a nativity scene, Snoopy, toy soldiers, a snowman holding a countdown to Christmas sign, and more. The playlist is 68 songs long, spanning from Santa Claus Coming to Town by Mariah Carey to Yabba Dabba Yuletide by the Brian Setzer Orchestra. The house at 7510 Guest Road is dripping in cheer. Mary Jane and Terry Mangum are the self-named crew of two who put the show together. When describing how this tradition began, Terry and Mary Jane chuckle. Terry describes it as an affliction more than anything else. Mary Jane's from Brooklyn, New York, and in 1979 the couple visited her childhood neighborhood. Terry was entranced by the lights along the street. I just really like Christmas lights, Terry says. They got married in 1986, moved into their first house in Durham, and he was finally able to put up lights in their yard on Daffodil Lane. At first, the lights were static. Also, the Mangums were at the end of a dead-end street. No one was making an excursion to see their lights. Well, in 2006, everything changed with a device called the, what else, Light-O-Rama. They could synchronize the lights and music. They started with six songs on a constant repeat. Terry explains, you just pick a song, and then with that program, you sit there and tell the computer when you want the light on or when you want it off. It also added to their preparation time. It's a long, tedious process. At the time, it was taking probably anywhere from 8 to 12 hours for each minute of song to get everything synchronized. They add on a few songs each year. When word traveled of the light show on Daffodil Lane, cars lined the entire street, taking turns three at a time, parking in front of the Mangum house to get a peek. In 2013, they moved to Guess Road. There, people could pull off to the side of the road and spend time listening to the music and watching the lights for as long as they wished. The Mangums were also free to expand their show. They didn't have neighbors close by to worry about on their 25 acres of land. They now have a tree that they refer to as a peacock tail. It has 16 different strings of lights that can link to music. In the song Disco Santa, a tune that replaces YMCA with N-O-E-L, the tree acts out scenes of reindeer and children. It is an immense amount of work for just the two of them. Terry says, we're not as quick as we used to be. and we always try to have it ready the Sunday before Thanksgiving, and we were able to do that this year. To the Mangum family, it's proper to play Christmas music even before Thanksgiving. The light show begins at 5:30 p.m. each evening and ends at 10 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and Friday and Saturday at 11 p.m. From inside the house, you can hear the faint singing, and Mary Jane says, I end up humming every song. The Christmas cheer doesn't stop inside the house. As the Mangums explained their affliction, they showed off their 7 different trees. There is a tree that snows, and a tree dedicated to the Beatles. There is a table dedicated to the 1983 film A Christmas Story, and a sign that says, I have OCD, Obsessive Christmas Disorder. When asked about why they put so much work into this tradition, Terry responds, well, you know, remembering the reason for the season and the tradition of families share with us. Families come by each year in their pajamas, cradling mugs of hot chocolate. Each night there are cars lined up watching in awe. On their Facebook page, the couple posts updates of how the setup's coming along. Starting in early September, the playlist for each evening had new additions to the light show that year. Fans respond with eager anticipation for the beginning of this season. Terry appreciates how much joy it brings to visitors. It's them telling us how much it means to us, and they thank us, and I'm thinking to myself, we enjoy these lights ourselves. Everybody just has a beautiful smile on their face. It just makes you feel good. The lights will play until New Year's Eve. They shut off just before midnight, Terry says. That gives us time to get in and get ready to watch the ball drop. The Mangum family's obsession with lights has spread joy across Durham County for 36 years. Still, Terry jokes, we don't want anybody to get electrocuted. That wouldn't be a lot of fun for the celebration of Christmas. Continuing now with online, IndyWeek.com, Raleigh Mayer announces new committee assignments. The 4 new city council members will have influence over the city's approach to environment, economy, transportation, and neighborhoods with new committee assignments. Mary Ann Baldwin, the mayor, announced the new makeup last week following the November election. 4 new members take places on the city council. Mary Black, representing District A, Megan Patton, District B, Jane Harrison, District D, and Christina Jones, District E. The newcomers, all women, represent some of the youngest city council members ever elected. During their campaigns, all pushed for a more transparent city council, including better engagement with residents, following controversy over the city's dismantling of citizen advisory councils. Jones has also taken a strong stance against Baldwin's pro-development agenda, arguing residents should have more input on rezoning and that the city council should push developers to build more affordable housing. The environment has also been a big talking point for new city council members, particularly Black and Harrison, who are professional environmentalists. Harrison, a coastal economic specialist, will chair the Growth and Natural Resource Committee next year, which was previously chaired by Nicole Stewart, who declined to run for re-election. The makeup of the committee is entirely new, with Black, an environmental activist, Patton, and the incumbent Corey Branch also serving on the committee. Incumbent Councilman Jonathan Milton will retain control of the Economic Development and Innovation Committee, which is charged with funding projects that encourage economic growth and supporting small businesses, among other things. In the past year, under Milton's leadership, the committee approved social districts downtown and created a new local law allowing people to run businesses from home. Baldwin will now serve as vice chair of this committee, a place previously held by David Knight, who lost his District E re-election to Jones. Black and at-large council member Stormy Forte will also serve on the committee. Transit and transportation is somewhat unchanged, with Branch remaining the chair and Melton moving up to vice chair to replace Patrick Bufkin, who also declined to run for re-election. The other 2 spots will be held by Harrison and Jones. Transit has been a major component in this debate over affordable housing. with the former city council pushing to build more along major transportation corridors. The city is also planning to increase investment in the bus system and improve public transportation. And safe, vibrant, and healthy communities. This committee is still chaired by Mayor Baldwin, and it has historically dealt with rezoning issues, historic and overlay districts, and homelessness. Forte is now vice chair, with Jones and Patton serving as members. This is one important committee to keep an eye on, given that most complex development issues land in front of it. The new makeup of the committee will also shake things up, with Jones and Patton now having a strong voice in this issue. We will shortly move to the print edition, but I will just mention one article which I will not be reading from either, and it's called Buyers Rejoice, and it's by Jasmine Gallup, and it's basically a large page full of bar graphs and statistics involving house prices, sales, and various indicators of what the housing market in the triangle is like. It's pretty complex, and I would just be reading percentages for you, and so I'll just refer anybody interested to go to IndieWeek.com, and this page is repeated there. So here's the first op-ed. Gabriel Gadsden writes, a call to action. Durham residents and political leaders should demand a redesign of Highway 55 from the Department of Transportation. In 2017, DOT began Project U3308, more commonly known as the Highway 55 Alston Avenue Expansion Project. DOT deemed the project necessary to reduce congestion and improve safety along the corridor of Highway 55, connecting Highway 70 to the Durham Freeway. The plan also included sidewalks on both sides of the roadway and wide outside lanes to accommodate bicycles. The road expansion was completed in 2021. However, nearly 5 years and millions of dollars later, congestion is no better than before, nor is pedestrian and bicycle travel safer. Though unfortunate, the tale of Project U3308 is not uncommon, as globally, municipalities strive to keep pace with rapidly changing cities. Too often, though, the plans approved impede progress. The Highway 55 project hurts Durham citizens rather than aiding congestion due to myriad issues, from failing to innovate outdated road planning, neglecting the reality of climate change, and disregarding social cohesion. Cities will continue to grow, and upgraded travel infrastructure will be needed. But in its present state, the 55 expansion program set Durham farther away from being prepared for the future, urban experts predict. To ensure North Carolina's future includes sustainable urban growth and development, an integrated and green redesign of 55's Alston Avenue corridor and the entire department planning process is needed and must be a top priority for citizens and political leaders. America's car-centric society has shaped urban design and form for decades. Urban sprawl and ardent individualism mean there are nearly 284 million cars on the road in the United States. Up until 3 decades ago, it was thought road expansion was the only viable solution for efficient travel. But the mega hybrid roads in the United States, including Highway 55, pair high-speed traffic with residential intersections and numerous traffic lights, creating traffic congestion that cannot be remedied by more lanes. Frameworks like the Dutch Sustainable Road Safety, which advocates for slower speeds and smaller lanes near residential areas, demonstrate that adding lanes around the Alston Avenue corridor was a callous decision. In addition to road expansion increasing congestion, it also increases the emission of greenhouse gases that are known to cause respiratory illness. Road expansion also increases stormwater runoff, polluting water systems, and increasing the urban heat island effect. In a world already experiencing more intense storms and drier weather, road development without environmental considerations is likely to lead to sewage overflows, localized flooding, and abnormally hot weather, all of which have the potential to cause public health emergencies for ill-prepared communities. If Department of Transportation had properly accounted for climate change, its highway design would have included significant funding for infrastructure, including bioswales, street trees, and more land for parks to mitigate air pollution, reduce heat islands, and manage stormwater runoff. Perhaps more importantly, forethought regarding the effects of climate change would have meant considering alternate forms of transportation altogether. These alternatives include fully protected bi-directional bike lanes, light rail, and updated bus infrastructure. Even without the introduction of costly projects like light rail and bus right-of-ways, the project may have been more successful at easing congestion with a thoughtful, integrated urban canopy planning and technology rather than more vehicle lanes. The development of urban roads also decreases social cohesion as roads widen and become more challenging to cross. The expansion of Highway 55 originally cut through East Durham neighborhood. East Durham was once a burgeoning upper middle class neighborhood supported by Durham's textile industry. Yet, like many affluent neighborhoods, the 1950s practices of blockbusting, neighborhood grading, and predatory lending left East Durham devoid of political capital and open to environmental degradation, reeling from generations of neglect and, frankly, racism. The 55 expansion project exacerbated these historical harms by avoiding environmental justice rather than embracing it. Instead of adding green space and greenway overpass bridges to connect Durham residents, Highway 55 continues to bisect a minority community while doing nothing to quell the air pollution exposure of nearby residents. The expansion ignored urban ecology's best practices of collaborative thinking and resilient infrastructure and was counterproductive to climate justice, public health, and neighborhood solidarity goals. For a community that has already experienced neglect for nearly 70 years, that expansion will likely only exacerbate disinvestment as large, expansive roads are unideal for communities to who strive to congregate. I suspect many Durham natives have spent countless miles on Highway 55. It truly is the main artery of Durham, as it takes drivers to Highway 70, the Durham Freeway, Highway 85, and Interstate 40. The illustrious NC Central University borders Highway 55, and the Union Insurance Building and numerous recreation centers are blocks away in either direction. Should one of the oldest roads in Durham that connects numerous neighborhoods and is dotted with history not be more than asphalt to ease congestion? A sustainable redesign of Highway 55 is a necessity. Durham's environmentalists, activists, and planners must reevaluate what 55 represents to Durham and more broadly North Carolina. Project U3308 suffered from a lack of integrated and complex thinking needed to build a sustainable city and tackle the challenges facing many urban cores. Highway 55 can ill afford to remain shackled to antiquated ideas of urban expansion. Rather than putting Durham further from reaching its goals of decarbonization, Highway 55 can be an example of sustainable urban design meant to adapt to the trends of urbanization while creating healthy and connected citizens. And the author of this op-ed, Gabriel Gadsden, is a second-year PhD student at Yale School of the Environment and is a Durham native. Now, longtime staffers Jasmine Gallup and Sarah Edwards have collaborated on a feature, which is the cover of the print edition of the Indie Week, called Reasons to Love the Triangle. And there are so many reasons. You'll find a big list of reasons. I believe it's 23. And so here's why living here this year was great and why next year could be even greater than the last. I forecast a positive take on many of these items that they're talking about, and in order of their printing. One, in-person events are back. After 2 years of COVID isolation, the Triangle cautiously came back to life this summer, with people flocking to music festivals, plays, and pride parades. They're all back in person. Two, workers are organizing. The movement for workers' rights started strong in North Carolina when baristas at a Raleigh Starbucks decided to unionize in March. Employees across the Triangle soon joined a nationwide movement for better pay and working conditions, with workers at a local restaurant and a Planet Fitness franchise deciding to strike. It's an exciting time for employees who seem to finally have the power. Who knows what next year will bring? Three, tenants are organizing. North Carolina is still a landlord-friendly state, but after facing possible homelessness during COVID and rising prices afterwards, tenants are taking a strong stand against an unfair system. In Durham, Walltown residents united to push the city council to use a rezoning request as leverage for affordable housing, while vulnerable residents on the Eno River are resisting eviction. Four. The local music scene continues to bend the rules. Staging a miniature music festival at a ballpark? Check. Sourcing musical materials from a 19th century rug? Check. Giving a Gen Z spin to Gen X label aesthetics? Check. Releasing music and foregoing standard streaming platforms altogether? Check. Going 20 years between record releases? Check. We could go on. Number five, the Raleigh City Council is now majority women. Some Raleigh residents may not be completely happy with this year's City Council election results, given that Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin's pro-development agenda will likely face some resistance from newcomers. But it's hard to get mad at the youngest, most diverse City Council in North Carolina's history, one that also now includes six women. Number six, Crook's Corner literary reputation lives on. When the corner announced it was shuttering in the summer of 21, the Chapel Hill restaurant's closure made national news, but hoped for the famed Southern institution still sparks. The Crook's Corner Book Prize has endured, continuing to nurture emerging writers, and pop-up openings peddling honeysuckle sorbet and other Crook's staples have continued to nurture our hope that the restaurant will reopen. Fingers crossed for 2023 at Crook's Corner. Now, said number seven, now Congressman Jeff Jackson is making waves on Reddit. He's a new North Carolina senator who was elected to U.S. Congress this November, has always had a reputation for straight shooting, particularly in his infamous AMAs on Reddit. After Election Day, Jackson stayed true to form, using his large social media following to give people a first-hand account of what happens after you get elected to Congress. 8. Secrets are just a dusty road away. Earlier this summer, the question, did the Duffer Brothers-based Hawkins Laboratory in Stranger Things on the Pittsburgh Big Hole facility evolved quickly into, wait, what exactly is Big Hole? Several thousand words later, we know more about the mysterious Cold War-era facility, though it's still behind a locked gate. Number 9, reading series are back and better than ever. In-person reading series have been one of the last kinds of events to return to the public sphere since the pandemic. But between local bookstores like Flyleaf and Letters and scrappy local series like Paradiso and Evenings, it's easier than ever to go hear a favorite writer or to discover a new one. Number 10, Ira David Wood's A Christmas Carol is still making fun of Republicans. After nearly 50 years, the Triangle's local production is a holiday tradition for many families, and it did not disappoint this year. Continuing to make audiences laugh with well-timed physical humor, inside jokes for repeat viewers, and North Carolina-specific jabs at Donald Trump, COVID naysayers, and Ticketmaster. Number 11, the North Carolina Museum of Art keeps getting better. It's looking to the future with its new environmentally friendly renovation, an increasing number of guest artists, and creating visiting exhibits. For art lovers around the Triangle, it's exciting to see the museum growing and changing, their questionable new logo aside. And 12, new performance groups and venues are popping up. It's not easy running a theater company in 2023, and yet new companies like Redbird and Fun Mom Band are springing up alongside new venues like Mettlesome's Golden Belt location to host these companies. 13. People care about abortion rights. They may be far from secure in North Carolina, but it's certainly not because pro-choice advocates have been quiet. Earlier this year, the leak of the U.S. Supreme Court's draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade prompted statewide protests and drew hundreds to downtown Raleigh to speak up. 14. Drinking downtown has more variety. After years of debate, the Raleigh City Council finally added a little fun to downtown Raleigh by allowing open containers on and around Fayetteville Street, shortly followed by a similar decision from the Durham City Council for its own downtown. We haven't seen much partying yet, but just wait until next summer. 15. Seaboard Station is still around. Development is a hot topic these days, but one thing most can agree on is that more people should participate in local government. This year, thanks to an active community group, Raleigh residents got involved and managed to save a property with a rich history from demolition. Number 16, going to the Nasher Gallery is free. Thanks to a $1 million donation from two Duke alumni, the Nasher Museum of Art is now indefinitely free to the public. Seize the day now by going to see the museum's Roy Lichtenstein exhibition and return in February to see Spirit in the Land. 17. Local officials are buying back guns. The Triangle made a big, positive step this year by holding gun buybacks, which turned out to be massively popular. Ultimately, law enforcement officials collected hundreds of guns from Raleigh and Durham owners who felt that selling them to the government was the best thing to do. 18. The first state monument to black North Carolinians is going up. The first state monument to African Americans, dubbed Freedom Park, took years to set in motion, but this fall construction finally began on the one-acre park and 40-foot-tall Beacon of Freedom, shining a light on the contributions of black residents to the state. 19. Triangle teens are walking out in protest. Like high school students across the country, Triangle teens are taking a stand on climate change, gun control, and abortion rights, mostly by walking out of classrooms. Bring on the next generation of lawmakers and leaders. 20. The LGBTQ community has new protections. They scored a major victory this summer when Raleigh finally got with the times and passed a local non-discrimination ordinance. Now the rights of people who are queer are stronger than ever, at least on paper. Those who are discriminated against in public or at work have the right to hold their antagonists accountable. Number 21. Raleigh is home to a cheese rolling champion. What do you do after graduating from NC State? Apparently, you travel to England and become the first American woman to win the Cooper's Hill Annual Cheese Rolling Championship in Gloucester. Thanks, Abby Lamp, for giving us something unique to celebrate. And cheese leads us to number 22. The international food scene is alive and well. The restaurant industry took a major hit during COVID, with some of our old favorites closing. This year, however, many ambitious residents took advantage of pandemic downtime to finally open their own restaurants, including in Durham, a new Polish bakery, Chef Chick's Bakery, and a French-Algerian bakery, La Recette Pâtisserie, and in Kerry, a micro bakery selling Filipino sweets, Bad Oven. Finally, number 23, the American Dance Festival is back. COVID necessitated that the prestigious festival become a smattering of online and short weekend events, but seeing dance in person is truly special, and this year the festival returned with 15 programs and a bonus weekend. Finally, at the bottom of this page, articles, bonus, thanks to the Orange County Animal Service Working Barn Cats Initiative, local feral cats are getting jobs as mousers. They give a shout out to Indy feline subjects, Alvin, Simone, and Theodore. 23 reasons to look forward to the next year in the Triangle. Next, for the thousands and thousands of listeners who heard me read from Indie Week last week's issue about the censorship beat, this is Project Censored's top 10 most censored news stories of 2022. And this is a continuation of that. I read the first five, most censored, self-censored, I might add, not governmental censored, major stories across the United States. And here are number 6 through 10. Number 6, corporate consolidation is causing record inflation in food prices. Project Censored reports, the establishment press has covered the current wave of inflation exhaustively, but only rarely will discuss the market power of giant firms as a possible cause, and then usually only to reject it, as they did when the Biden administration cited meat industry consolidation as a cause of price increase in September of 2021. Quote, treating administration attempts to link inflation to consolidation as a rhetorical move meant to distract from conservative critiques of Biden's stimulus program. But as Food and Water Watch reported in November of 21, while the cost of meat shot up, prices paid to farmers actually declined, spurring a federal investigation that is ongoing, but meat conglomerates Tyson, Perdue, Smithfield, and JBS have just paid over $225 million to settle related civil suits in the poultry, beef, and pork markets. That's just part of the problem. A July 21 joint investigation by Food and Water Watch and The Guardian reported that a handful of food giants, including Kraft, Heinz, General Mills, Conagra, Unilever, and Del Monte, control an average of 64% of sales of 61 popular grocery items. Three companies own 93% of carbonated soft drink brands, while another three produce 73% of the cereals on offer, and a single company, PepsiCo, owns five of the most popular dip brands, 88% of the market. Altogether, The Guardian reported four firms or fewer controlled at least 50% of the market for 79% of the groceries. It's not just producers. In an October article for Common Dreams, Kenny Stancil documents that food producers, distributors, and grocery store chains are engaging in pandemic profiteering and taking advantage of decades of consolidation, which has given a handful of corporations an ever greater degree of market control and, with it, the power to set prices. As for grocers, Kroger, the largest chain in the country, cited rising inflation as the reason for hiking prices in their stores, even as they cut worker pay by 8%. Yet, as Stancil explained, the Kroger CEO publicly gloated, "It's a little bit of inflation is always good for business." That CEO earned 900 times what the median worker earned, while worker pay decreased by 8% in 2020. And the company spent almost $1.5 billion on stock buybacks between April of 20 and July of 21 to enrich its shareholders. Kroger was one of just four companies that took an estimated two-thirds of all grocery sales in 2019. More broadly, a report for the American Prospect by Rakim Mahboud, chief economist at the Groundwork Collaborative, and Dave Dayan revealed that one of the most common inflation scapegoats, supply chain problems, is itself a consequence of consolidation. The project censored noticed just three global alliances of ocean shippers are responsible for 80% of all cargo. These shippers raked in nearly $80 billion in the first three quarters of 2021, twice as much as in the entire 10-year period from 2010 to 2020, by increasing their rates as much as tenfold. Supply chain consolidation reflects a broader shift in the global economy, argued The Prospect. In 1970, Milton Friedman argued in the Times, New York Times, that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. Manufacturers used that to rationalize the financial imperative to benefit shareholders by seeking the lowest cost labor possible. This led to a surge in outsourcing to East Asia and eventually China, adding new costs for shipping, but deregulating all the industries in the supply chain could more than compensate. Occasionally, articles touched on the issue of consolidation, mostly to debunk it, though there are a couple of opinion pieces to the contrary. But these isolated opinion pieces were far outnumbered by the hundreds, even thousands of reports and analyses by commercial media outlets that blamed everything but oligopolistic price gouging for the rising cost of groceries. Number seven, concerns for journalistic independence grow as Gates Foundation gives over $300 million to news outlets. The list of billionaires with media empires includes familiar names like Rupert Murdoch, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and most recently Elon Musk. But, quote, while other billionaires' media empires are relatively well known, the extent to which Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates cash underwrites the modern media landscape is not well known. Alan McLeod wrote for Mint Press News in November 2021. McLeod examined more than 30,000 individual grants from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and found, quote, it had donated more than $310 million to fund news outlets, journalism centers and training programs, press associations and specific media campaigns, raising questions about conflicts of interest and journalistic independence. McLeod wrote, today it's possible for an individual to train as a reporter, thanks to a Gates Foundation grant, find work on a Gates-funded outlet, and to belong to a press association funded by Gates. Recipients of this cash include many of America's most important news outlets, including CNN, NBC, NPR, PBS, and The Atlantic. Gates also sponsors a myriad of influential foreign organizations, including the BBC, The Guardian, The Financial Times, and The Daily Telegraph in the United Kingdom, prominent European newspapers like Le Monde, Der Spiegel, and El País, as well as big global broadcasters like Al Jazeera. McLeod's report includes a number of Gates-funded news outlets that also regularly feature in Project Censored's annual top 25 story lists, such as the Solutions Journalism Network, The Conversation, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and ProPublica, in addition to The Guardian and Atlantic. Quote, direct awards to news outlets often targeted specific issues. For example, CNN received $3.6 million to support, quote, journalism on the everyday inequalities endured by women and girls across the world, according to one grant. Another grant earmarked over $2 million for the Texas Tribune to increase public awareness and engagement of education reform issues in Texas. As McLeod noted, given Gates' advocacy of the charter school movement, which undermines teachers' unions and effectively aims to privatize the public education system, a cynic might interpret this as planting pro-corporate charter school propaganda into the media, disguised as objective news reporting. McLeod said there are clear shortcomings with this non-exhaustive list, meaning the true figure is undoubtedly far higher. First, it doesn't count sub-grants, money given by recipients to media around the world, because there's no record of them. For tax-privileged charity that so very often trumpets the importance of transparency is remarkable how intensely secretive the Gates Foundation is about its financial flows. Also missing were grants aimed at producing articles for academic journals, although, quote, they regularly form the basis for stories in the mainstream press and help shape narratives around key issues. The Gates Foundation has given far and wide to academic sources, with at least $13.5 million going towards creating content for the prestigious medical journal The Lancet. And more broadly, even money given to universities for purely research projects eventually ends up in academic journals and ultimately downstream into mass media. Neither these, nor grants funding the printing of books or the establishment of websites, counted in the total, although they too are forms of media. Project Censored noted no major corporate news outlets appear to have covered this issue. This despite the fact that as far back as 2011, the Seattle Times published an article investigating how the Gates Foundation's growing support of media organizations blurs the line between journalism and advocacy. I'll outline some of these to save time for some other articles, but number 8 in this top 10 self-censorship, the CIA had discussed plans to kidnap or kill Julian Assange. There's several articles about this, and they're referred to in this Indie Week. Number 9, new laws preventing dark money disclosures sweep the nation. They're underreported, too. The American Legislative Exchange Council brings together corporate lobbyists and conservative lawmakers to advance special interest, business-friendly legislation. How much of that is covered is the point of this whole article. We don't see much of it. And number 10, major media outlets are lobbying against the regulation of, quote, surveillance advertising. And that's collecting user data to target them with tailored advertising. It's become extremely profitable and almost ubiquitous on the world's most popular social media apps, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, etc. But now, the Biden administration's Federal Trade Commission, FTC, is seeking to regulate user data collection. Lobbyists for the Interactive Advertising Bureau, of course there's a bureau, are pushing back. In a letter, they called for the FTC to oppose a ban on data-driven advertising networks, claiming the modern media cannot exist without mass media, without mass data collection. So there are several more paragraphs on all of these stories. And this was a copyright, this whole story, Random Lengths News, which is reprinted in the Indie Week. But we must continue now, and I want to make sure to cover these more local articles. And the first is by Lena Geller from Durham, called Lunch Hour. On a Tuesday in September, more than 75 Riverside High School students spent their lunch period crammed into a history classroom, voluntarily signing up for more homework. It was the interest meeting for Model UN, a club where students role-play as delegates to the United Nations and debate real-world problems like climate change and nuclear proliferation, and the turnout was unprecedented. Model UN is one of the most academically intensive clubs offered at Riverside. But given that the previous two school years at the Durham School may have been dominated by remote online learning, it makes sense that students were especially drawn to the globally-minded club this year, despite the extra work it entails, says Sam Ostrovsky, a sophomore and one of Riverside's four Model UN club leaders, saying Model UN allows people to broaden their knowledge of the world outside their bedrooms, which we were all trapped in during the pandemic. In 60 seconds, Ostrovsky lists multiple examples of said knowledge, that Mexicans and Spaniards speak different dialects of Spanish for one, or that Ukrainians and Russians speak two different languages despite sharing Slavic ancestry and using the Cyrillic script. He says, can you imagine if people commonly knew these kinds of things? We would all get along a better. There'd be fewer political problems and divisiveness because so many of our current problems come from not knowing what's happening in other places. The club also bolsters students' public speaking skills, he adds. While attendance has dropped a bit since the interest meeting, Model UN is still going strong, with more than 50 students who regularly attend the club's weekly gatherings. But like the majority of clubs at Riverside, Model UN's engagement relies on one variable, the school's lunch schedule. In the fall of 2019, Riverside's then-principal, Tonya Williams, made a major alteration to the school's lunch model. For years, Riverside used a three-cycle lunch schedule where students were assigned to A, B, or C launch windows that took place before third period, in the middle of third period, or after third period, respectively. For classes, Riverside uses a block schedule where students attend four 90-minute course periods each day. When the school was using the three-cycle lunch model, students' lunch were dictated by their third period class. All students in third period journalism, for instance, were assigned to B lunch. But Tonya Williams had a different idea. If every student at Riverside shared a single hour-long lunch period, smart lunch, she called it, there could be all sorts of benefits. With smart lunch, all students could eat at the reasonable time of 12:15 p.m. Because smart lunch would be lengthier than the 45-minute ABC periods, and because it would allow all teachers to hold the same office hours, students would have the time and the accessibility to do more than just eat. After polishing off their PB&Js, they could attend 30-minute club meetings or tutoring sessions, visit teachers to complete makeup tests or missing classwork, or for seniors, knock out a few college applications. In this sense, the smart lunch model promised to alleviate stress, increase equity, and boost academic performance among students. Students long thwarted from participating in after-school activities, those who play sports or who rely on the school bus for transport, could join clubs and engage with their coursework in ways that were previously impossible. And students with medical issues, who frequently have to scramble to coordinate makeup tests with multiple teachers, would have a reliable time window to complete their work. Of course, some students would use the entire lunch period to socialize, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Students with social anxiety would be guaranteed the same lunch period as their friends. And though Williams didn't know this at the time, the pandemic would severely worsen social anxiety among high schoolers in the coming years. Williams first pitched the idea of smart lunch in 2017, but waited to roll out the program until 2019, when she had gotten 80% buy-in from faculty and staff, according to a teacher who spoke with Indy on the condition of anonymity. While a handful of other North Carolina high schools had implemented similar models, Riverside would be the first Durham public school institution to put it into practice. That seemed risky to some faculty members. And because smart lunch, at least in its original form, would allow Riverside's 1,600-plus students to roam the halls as they desired, as opposed to being sequestered in the cafeteria, some teachers feared that safety issues would arise from their inability to supervise the entire campus. Ultimately, though, most faculty members felt the potential benefits of the model greatly outweighed the risks, and school leadership devised a comprehensive rotating supervision system where teachers would serve one lunch duty shift each week. In August 2019, when students who were currently seniors were entering high school as bright-eyed freshmen, Smart Lunch finally saw its debut. Just over one semester later, the pandemic put a long-term pause on the new initiative, but since Riverside's return to in-person learning in the spring of 2021, students, who spoke with both Indy and Wade Gabriel, a Riverside senior, for this story, overwhelmingly feel that Williams' vision has been realized. Williams herself couldn't be reached for comment. She left Riverside in early 2021 to take a position as area assistant superintendent for Johnston County Public Schools. Ostrovsky, the Model UN leader, dedicates his after-school hours to running cross-country and winter and spring track. The other three club leaders also play sports. Ostrovsky says, "There's no chance that any of us would be able to lead the club if we didn't have smart lunch." He adds that he and his fellow leaders devote three lunch periods to planning, hosting and reviewing model UN meetings each week. The club would essentially dissolve. Model UN aside, Ostrowski says Smart Lunch plays an integral role in allowing him to maintain good grades, as he frequently misses chunks of his fourth period class due to athletic obligations. There's no chance that I would have straight A's right now if I didn't have the allotted 1 hour time to study and go to tutoring and take makeup tests. This is really the biggest blessing that I've ever come across. More than 20 other students offer similar praise. Elena Paces Wiles, a junior who runs cross country, says, I was spent pretty much every Wednesday and Friday in Mr. Boland's Smart Lunch last year in order to understand the content. That's the only reason I got distinguished in the exam and an A in the class, even though I'm not very STEM oriented. Owen Transu says, it legit kept me from failing. It's a huge mental health benefit. With Smart Lunch, students say their grades are higher, their college applications are bolstered, their social needs are filled, and their stomachs are fed before any kind of hunger-induced brain fog kicks in. And through a pandemic lens, the initiative could not have come at a better time. In North Carolina, only 45% of students in grades K-12 passed the state reading, math, and science exams during the 2021 school year. Low-income students and minorities faced the worst, with proficiency ratings in the mid to high 20th percentile. So at a school like Riverside, where around 60% of the students are Black or Hispanic, and 35% of students are eligible for free or reduced-price lunch, pandemic-induced learning loss has been a major concern. But thanks to Smart Lunch, Riverside students have been able to put extra time into recovering learning losses, and from a more long-term perspective, many feel they're more confident in their ability to complete coursework. That is, until 3 months ago when Smart Lunch was abruptly, but temporarily, taken away. As at many public high schools, physical fights among students have long been an issue at Riverside, with administrators left puzzling over how to best address a systemic problem that's rooted outside the walls of the school. Mandatory hall pass, well-publicized disciplinary consequences, and the presence of school resource officers act as a first line of prevention. In 2017, when this Indy reporter was a senior at Riverside, administrators implemented a policy that punished student bystanders, students who took video recordings of fights, with 5 days of out-of-school suspension to further deter violence between students. The policy is no longer listed in the Riverside student handbook. Still, the fights persist, and now it seems a Smart Lunch may be in the hot seat. On September 22nd at 4:09 p.m., 6 minutes before the end of the school day, teachers received an email from administrators that detailed a shift back to the ABC lunch schedule to be implemented immediately the next day. As the Pirates Hook student newspaper reported, parents received an automated call from Riverside's current principal, Dr. Gloria Woods Weeks, an hour later, who cited safety concerns as the reason behind the schedule change. Quote, we're very proud of our Smart Lunch program, but we have had some recent concerning incidents during lunchtime that do not meet our standards of respectful behavior between fellow students. Woods Week did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. The suspension would be temporary, Woods Weeks continued. The model would be reinstated after administrators had a chance to, quote, reset, revamp our program, and have those conversations with students who we need to have conversations with. Indeed. 2 weeks later, Smart Lunch returned, but not before students saw what their lives would be like without it. In that 2 week interim, students who typically use Smart Lunch to study and complete makeup work say they experienced extreme anxiety over their grades and lost their grasp on class material. Clubs and tutoring sessions hastily rescheduled to before school hours saw a plummet in attendance. Students assigned to the C lunch block at 1:55 p.m. were so hungry they couldn't pay attention in class. Things felt so dire that two students quickly launched separate petitions calling on administrators to immediately reinstate the model. One petition received 345 signatures, while the other, created by senior Miles Etu, gathered a whopping 1,268. Etu says, if two kids fought in class, let's say it's Math 2, would you cancel the class? Would you cancel Math 2 and take away the opportunity for everyone? The week that Smart Lunch was revoked, Riverside administrators held four grade-wide assemblies to screen slideshows about school safety and listen to feedback about students. Most students expressed a strong desire for Smart Lunch to continue, and some offered solutions to the administration's safety concerns. The lunch duty map could be reworked to place more teachers in areas where fights are most common, or students who break school rules could be required to spend Smart Lunch in designated classroom. Students say they didn't feel particularly heard. Administrators weren't writing down anything they said and sometimes countered their suggestions on the spot as being unfeasible. Some students sent follow-up emails to Woods Weeks but received identical copy-paste responses and were left with a sense that she didn't read their feedback. Regardless, on October 6th, Smart Lunch was reinstated and things returned to normal. Then in early December, students started to hear rumors, credible rumors, they say, from their own teachers that the model would end permanently at the start of the spring semesters. Two teachers, each of whom spoke with Indy on the condition of anonymity, say to their knowledge there is no concrete plan to cancel Smart Lunch. But one of the teachers, we'll call him Mr. Johnson, shared that faculty members have reasons to believe that the model will soon be revoked, and feel that the principal's calls for student and teacher input are a charade. On Friday of last week, teachers were asked to attend meetings with administrators during their planning periods to discuss Smart Lunch, Johnson says. The majority of teachers in his meeting were strong proponents of the model, he says. Many echoed the safety tips that students had suggested, with some adding a post-lunch tardy sweep could be helpful. Several of this year's larger fights happened just after Smart Lunch transitioned into third period. Well, I must reluctantly stop broadcasting this issue of Indy Week because of time considerations. And here comes our German artillery band, some 50-plus strong, marching their complex formations. And from underneath my desk where I'm hiding, I can see they're spelling out my name, Jay Federson. Very good job, gentlemen. And the NCRS as they perform the theme for Indy Week. And we'll have this issue of Indy Week as a podcast, and we'll return just before New Year's, I believe. And you can find this issue online in our ncreadingservice.org. So long from John Federson and Indy Week.